Okay, good morning, everybody. Some of you are done with your lab. All right, fantastic. All right, so this is our last lecture, and we're going to have a lecture on reproductive system. And let's see, but I think we have a final a week from today, is that right? Yeah, and I think it's probably like at 10:30 to 12:30. I don't have my notes in front of me. Oh, and I don't have a sign-in sheet today. Rats. Last day, last class. Yeah, go ahead. Pass one around if somebody's got a piece of paper. The overhead's not working. So I'm going to find some transparencies to go over some of this stuff. So I don't have the computer working today. Yeah, thank you so much. All right, now, what chapter is it? 24? No, wait, 24 is urinary system. Oh, wait, I just pulled out the wrong file. It's behind the... this looks good. All right, so I always have a question. What's the, we always like to talk a little bit about the function of the various parts of anatomy that you're talking about. Well, what's the function of the reproductive system? And some people are laughing and shaking their head back and forth. No. Why are you laughing, saying no? Somebody tell me, besides somebody in the front row, what's the purpose of the reproductive system? Yeah, so what does that really mean, to produce something new and unique? It's not just to, it's just not reproduction, all right? Because if it was just to reproduce yourself, there are many organisms that can reproduce themselves. There are organisms that can grow a bud off of their torso, and a new organism will form, like hydras and anemones and things like that, and then that little organism will break off and will wander around the environment, right? Just a freestanding organism, just like the parent. All right, but for humans, it's quite a bit different, right? You need two people, and the person that's born is going to be a unique combination of the parents. All right, so that's really the important thing, that everybody is new and unique, and that's probably as plain as the nose on your face, because when you look around the room, do you see anybody exactly like you? No, you don't see anybody like you at all. As a matter of fact, if you think of your mom, okay, if you're a woman in here, when you think of your mom, are you exactly like your mom? You might kind of be close, but not really. You're different, right? And if you're a guy in here, are you exactly like your dad? Chances are, no. You might be similar in some ways, but you're not just a duplicate copy, right? So sexual reproduction produces new and unique life forms. That's why it's so complicated. That's why some people have a vagina and other people have a penis, right, and a uterus, ovaries, testes. It just seems all so complicated. But the beauty of that is that with all those structures working together, right, you can produce something new and unique. And that's the most important thing about reproduction in people. All right, so bottom line, sexual reproduction, since it produces something new and unique, it produces diversity in a population, right? So that we're not all the same. That's real important because, for instance, if there is a swine flu virus going around, is everybody going to come down with it? No. And even if it was a lethal form, would the whole human population die? No, because we're not homogeneous. We're not all the same. We're all different, right? So that's the important thing for sexual reproduction. Okay. Now, I asked you to find out something about irony. What's irony mean? What is, when something's ironic, what does that mean? And I'm asking you because I see a lot of irony when it comes to sex. It's one of my favorite ironies that I think about. Why? What does irony mean? What does irony mean? I could give you an example. There were some fires in Santa Barbara. Okay, and a lot of people lost their homes, and firefighters got hurt and caused a lot of damage. And it came out on the radio today how it started, and I find that very ironic. All right, it started because somebody was clearing brush because they were afraid that a fire was going to start. So in the process of clearing brush away, they started a fire by accident that burned a bunch of homes down, almost 100 homes. All right, so that's irony. Irony is when you do something, but the consequences are different, or that the results are different than what you expect. All right, and so I see that with sex a lot, because this is what I find ironic about sex. How everybody likes sex, but hardly anybody likes what? Diversity. But what's the purpose of sex? To produce new and unique stuff all the time. Okay, something different. All right, so that's that. I find that very ironic. Interesting and ironic. You know what I mean? Yeah, maybe? Okay. Well, so let's look at some of these structures. I don't really have all my notes in front of me because I don't have the computer going. But let's see if we can cover some of the things that might be on the test a week from today. All right, so let's start with the male reproductive system. Okay. Okay. Yeah, this is it. Right here. All right, and so we're going to start with spermatogenesis and the organ that where spermatogenesis takes place is in the testes right here, all right? And you only see one, but of course there's two in the normal individual. And what is a little bit different about this organ right here? It's not in the?
Inside the body.
Yeah, it's not in the pelvic cavity, not in the abdominal cavity. It's actually suspended in the scrotum right here. And does anybody know the reason why that is? Yeah, because spermatogenesis doesn't take place at body temperature. It has to be lower than body temperature, all right? And so the testes are suspended in the scrotum so that they can be cooler. And also, some people are born with a testes up in the pelvic cavity, or you might even have some animals at home if you raise cats or dogs, or maybe some of you raise horses or cattle or whatever, all right? And whenever a male is born, you should check to make sure that both testes are in the scrotum and not retained in the pelvic cavity. Does anybody know why that's a really good idea? Okay. Because when a testes is at normal body temperature, it has a tendency to become cancerous. And then, of course, that's going to kill the individual. All right. So it always has to be removed. So if you have some very favorite pets that has a crypt orchid, an ovary or testes is an orchid, crypt means hidden in the pelvic cavity, it should be removed because it's going to turn cancerous otherwise. All right, so that's a big reason why it's in the scrotum right here. All right, so the testes produces sperm, and then sperm move through a bunch of little tubules, which maybe we'll talk about in the testes, into the epididymis where it's stored, and there's some final maturation of sperm in the epididymis. And then during ejaculation, right, that sperm moves from the epididymis into the vas deferens, and now the sperm moves all the way into the pelvic cavity via the inguinal canal. So there's a hiatus in the abdominal muscles right here, which we call the inguinal canal. And the vas deferens, another name for the vas deferens is ductus deferens. So you see the same. Make sure you know that it's the same terminology. It goes over the superior, lateral, and anterior part of the urinary bladder, and then posteriorly where it joins with a gland, right? And that's what we call the seminal vesicles. And the seminal vesicles add volume and function to the ejaculate, right? It contributes about 60% of the semen volume, and it contains sperm nutrients. Because what? Yeah, thanks. So what can you tell me about sperm? They're a very unique cell in the human body in terms of males and females in that. They're different. Why are they different? Okay. Well, they don't have like eyes and arms and things like that, but they move around. They're motile. What allows them to be motile? They have a flagellum. That's right. So they can swim around. So that's really the only cell in the human body that can swim around anywhere. Other cells exhibit motility because they have cilia, but they just move fluid over the surface of an epithelium. Okay. They don't float around. All right, so the seminal vesicle adds volume to the ejaculate, and then the vas deferens becomes the ejaculatory duct as it passes through this prostate gland. And the job of the prostate gland is to add volume to the ejaculate as well. And again, it provides motility agents. I think I gave you a whole list of things on your study sheet of what it provides for semen. And it also helps neutralize the acid environment of the male urethra because that motility of the sperm is very sensitive to pH. And it also neutralizes the acid environment of the vagina as well, which is going to deactivate the motility of the sperm. All right, so now we see that the urinary system and the reproductive system have joined together in the male. That's going to be an important contrast. And from the ejaculatory duct, it moves into the prostatic urethra, all right, and then through the perineum right here, and then it becomes the membranous urethra, and then it passes by one more gland. That's a really small one. That's the bulbourethral gland, and its job basically is to add maybe about 5% of the semen volume, and it secretes mucus. And mucus is, of course, a lubricant. It's a protein protein sugar compound that's very, very slippery, but because it's protein, it also acts as a buffer. So it helps neutralize acids in the male urethra and female vagina as well. Okay, and then we have the spongy urethra inside the penis, and then the ejaculate is outside the body. All right, now we're just talking about how important diversity is in the population, but remember back when we were talking about bones, I'd mentioned that there's a very kind of strange disease process that if every woman, especially woman, is lucky enough to live old enough, they have to deal with in one way or the other. And what was that disease process? It's going to affect everybody in here. Osteoporosis, right. Well, here is sort of a similar kind of disease, not in women, but in men, because women don't have a prostate or anything like a prostate gland. All right. If men are lucky enough to live old enough, they usually develop problems with this prostate. Okay, and does anybody know what that disease process is? And again, it's kind of noteworthy and strange because, yeah, that's when the prostate gland gets big. It's called hypertrophic prostate, all right? And when it gets big, guess what happens? It blocks the urethra, and then you can't void, or maybe it blocks the ejaculatory duct, all right? But the most prominent problem is blocking of the urethra, and then somebody can't void as a result of that. That's the main reason why old men can't. Those viejitos have a hard time going to the bathroom, okay? Because this prostate gland is enlarged, all right? So, of course, we can do surgery. We can insert a catheter with a balloon and blow up the walls of the prostate and make it patent again, all right? But it has a tendency to reoccur. But there's something else that we're also very concerned about, and that is if the prostate is enlarging and getting bigger, right, what are you always concerned about when some part of your body gets big and starts to grow? If it's cancer, now can part of that prostate, if it is cancerous, can it break away and form other cancers in other parts of the body? Then, of course, then we call that metastasis, and then, of course, that's a very deadly process. That's just not having trouble avoiding, but that's going to kill you. So sometimes it's very difficult to tell those two processes apart, all right? But people are getting better and better trying to differentiate that all the time. So I don't know. What would you rather have? Would you rather have osteoporosis as you get older or a hypertrophied prostate as you get older? Oh, the prostate, yeah. Yeah, if it's benign. But the trouble is, anytime you do surgery, guess what happens? You have scar tissue forming, right? And then that scar tissue might block the urethra again. So it's not always quite so simple as you think, okay? Okay. But nonetheless, I'd probably rather have a prostatic disease than osteoporosis, but on the other hand, you can protect yourself from osteoporosis. How do you do that? Diet and exercise. But then on the other hand, you can protect yourself from prostate disease by diet and exercise. The same thing, not the same kind of exercise that you do for your bones, but exercise for the prostate gland in particular. Okay? And low-fat diet. Sure. Yeah, because if that ejaculatory duct has to be removed, then there's no way for sperm to get from the testes to the outside world. Okay? So, absolutely. All right, well, in the penis, we also have some erectile tissue that can engorge with blood, and then it gets turgid, and All right, and that can maintain an erection. All right, so this is an analog. Oh, we haven't talked about the female reproductive tract, but we will. All right, so we have some erectile tissue in the penis. All right, so here is the ventral side. Here is the dorsal side of the penis. Okay, and so this right here is what we call the corpus spongiosum, the part that the urethra is going through in the ventral penis, right? And there's only one of those. But on the dorsal side, there are two, right here, the corpora cavernosa, that's plural. And on this particular section, we only see one, right? So if we look at a transverse section of the penis, right, you see the corpus spongiosum right here, and the two corpora cavernosa on either side. Okay. All right, so those are some of the salient features of the male reproductive system. So here we see the testes in the scrotum, and it's suspended on something we call the spermatic cord. And the spermatic cord has got a number of components to it. There is a testicular artery, a testicular vein, testicular nerves that go through the inguinal canal. All right, so here's the whole spermatic cord. And there's a cremaster muscle as well that helps suspend that whole apparatus right there. But notice that the vein, which is in color blue right here, it forms a plexus around the testicular artery. And that's really important because what is the temperature of the arterial blood going to the testes right here as it's going through the inguinal canal? It's at body temperature. All right, and 98.6 or 7, something like that. That's going to inhibit spermatogenesis, might turn that testes into a cancerous organ. So as that blood is flowing down to the testes through this inguinal canal, it is surrounded, almost coated, by the venous blood that's returning. Now, what's the temperature of the venous blood? Yeah, it's cold. All right, but because it's surrounding the testicular artery, what can you tell me about temperature? Yeah, it cools it down. So, for instance, if I give you an ice cube and put it in your hand, and then 30 seconds later you take that ice cube off your hand and feel your hand, what is your hand? Your hand is cold. All right, so here is a nice heat transfer apparatus that withdraws heat from the testicular artery, puts it into the testicular vein, and that cools the blood that's going to the testes, and that maintains spermatogenesis at the proper temperature. Okay? All right, so that's most of the things about the spermatic cord that I wish to talk about. Okay, including that prostate gland and how it can be problematic. All right, so this might be an exam figure. Probably one of those that I showed you is an exam figure. All right, make sure you know how to label all those different things. All right, so here we have a testes. Just wonder if I can turn the light down. No, okay, it's so bright I can't really see the slide very well. But anyway, here's the spermatic cord. All right, huh? If I turn around, I can, but I don't know if I can. You can see it. That's the important. Oh, you can't see it because it's off the slide. Okay. So inside the scrotum, there is an outer covering of the testes, right? That we call the tunica vaginalis. And vaginalis just means sheath. It's a covering for something. All right, so it doesn't have anything in particular to do with female anatomy. It's just a general term. And then inside the tunica vaginalis is the tunica albuginea, which means kind of a white material. And that white material causes these septations within the testes. All right, so that causes these different chambers, and inside these chambers we have seminiferous tubules, and that's the tubule that is responsible for spermatogenesis. So there are germ cells inside these different compartments that are going to produce the sperm, and a sperm is a gamete. So gametes are a little bit different than all the other cells in your body because they only have half the number of usual chromosomes that all the other cells in your body have. So the process that produces these gametes is not what we call mitosis, it's what we call meiosis, right? And I'm not requiring you to know much about meiosis in here other than that's the process that produces a gamete. Now why is it a good, so there are two kinds of gametes, male and female. So the male gamete is called a?
Meiosis only.
The male gamete is called, give me a specific name of a male gamete. That's a sperm. Okay, that's a sperm. And a female gamete is an egg or an oocyte. Okay, so why do you think a gamete, whether it's male or female, sperm or egg, why does it have half the number of usual chromosomes? Yeah, because gametes are going to recombine. All right, so a sperm is going to combine with an oocyte, and then since they're both carrying half the number of chromosomes, when you add those two nuclei together, what are you back at?
47.
The number, the regular number of chromosomes, which is 46. So human gametes have 23 chromosomes. All the other cells in your body have 46. And so the process of producing a gamete is what we call meiosis. And when a sperm and an egg join, it forms another kind of cell called a zygote. And you all were a zygote at one time. What's a zygote? It's just a single cell when an oocyte and sperm unite. And you all know what that process is called. What's a process that produces a zygote? That's called? I hear a lot of good answers, but I'm not sure that I heard the particular one I'm looking for. But you all know what it is. It's called?
Fertilization.
Yeah, it's called fertilization. All right. Okay. So here is the seminiferous tubules, and as sperm is being produced, it moves through these little straight tubes right here into the Reedy's testis and then finally into the epididymis where it's stored until ejaculation takes place. Okay. So if we look at a cross-section of a seminiferous tubule, here we see it right here. So here are cells that make up the tubule. So there are two kinds of cells. There are germ cells that produce sperm, and then there are Sertoli cells inside this tubule that secrete stimulatory chemicals and nutrients that allow for spermatogenesis to take place inside the seminiferous tubule. All right, so these are microscopic tubes. But you also see some cells outside the seminiferous tubule. We call those interstitial cells, meaning outside. And these cells have a little bit different kind of function. They secrete testosterone, which is the primary male sex hormone, right? And that sex hormone is necessary to maintain the sex structures that we're looking at, like the prostate and the seminal vesicles and the penis, and to maintain that function. And testosterone is even necessary to stimulate spermatogenesis. And the Sertoli cells are dependent on testosterone, right? So those interstitial cells or cells of Leydig are real important for controlling all aspects of the male reproductive system. Yeah. Okay. Oh, if they're using anabolic steroids.
Yeah, why is it true that?
You know, I'm not really sure, but I've heard those same stories that when people use anabolic steroids, okay, it interferes with other steroids that your body uses, like male sex steroids, testosterone. All right, so inhibits feedback mechanisms that might involve your brain and your pituitary gland, and maybe even your adrenal gland and your testes. And I do hear that people that abuse anabolic steroids do have decreased male function as a result of that. Okay, but I've never read one of those studies for sure. But if anybody has a reference on that, that would be interesting to know. There's a lot of confusion along those lines because sometimes you hear when somebody abuses anabolic steroids, like I remember a case of Lyle Elzado became very aggressive, okay, kind of uncontrollably aggressive, and he blamed abuse of anabolic steroids, okay, but if that inhibits testosterone, we usually link testosterone with aggressive behavior. So I don't know what the link there is. Okay, it's still, I don't know what the connections are. There's still a lot of information that's missing. Okay. All right, so I think maybe that's almost about it for the male reproductive system. Except maybe here, oh wait, here's a good picture too. Oh, this even might be an exam figure, because it shows the erectile tissue very, very nicely. All right, so here you can see the testes, epididymis, vas deferens going past the seminal vesicles into the ejaculatory duct, right? And then into the prostatic urethra, then through the membranous urethra, and then into the spongy urethra. And why do we call that the spongy urethra right there? Because it's right passing right through the corpus spongiosum, right? That's erectile tissue. All right, the corpus spongiosum even makes the glands of the penis, right? That's like the head of the penis right here. Here we can see the external urethral orifice. All right, so this whole urethra starting at the prostatic urethra, this is a common duct for what? The reproductive system as well as the urinary system in the male. Okay, males typically don't experience much in the way of bladder infections, okay, because this urethra is so long. Right, so males usually don't have much in the way of urinary tract infections, even though the urethra is a combined tube for both urinary and the reproductive system. All right, the other reason why this picture is pretty good, because here you can see both of the corpora cavernosa very, very nicely. And then again, if we look in high resolution of a cross-section, we can see the corpora cavernosa, right, bilaterally, and the corpus spongiosum right here. Okay. I think that's maybe all I'm going to say about the male reproductive system. Yeah, pretty much. That's about it. Oh, with the exception that spermatogenesis in the male does occur through the whole lifespan of the male. It does slow down as a male gets older, but nonetheless, males will undergo spermatogenesis their whole life after puberty, anyway. Okay. Okay, so who's got a question on the male reproductive system? How exactly does it get hard? A little bit beyond my expertise, but I think I have. There's some interesting neurotransmitters involved, okay? But the reason why it does, okay, because blood flows into this cavernous tissue and it doesn't flow out, okay? So blood has a tendency to pool, so this is like a big vein that fills with blood and it becomes turgid as a result of that. So, I don't have some other really good examples, though I did see something kind of interesting. Huh? Spongiosum, because it's filled with all these sinuses right here. Okay? And there are pharmaceuticals that you can take, well, males can take, right, for maintaining an erection. And it's kind of difficult to treat if it goes awry, because you can't just take vasodilators, right, to let the blood drain out, because if take the usual kind of dilators, that just really maintains the erection. Right, so when somebody takes male enhancement drugs, if somebody has an erection for, what do they say, 4 hours?
Yep.
Okay. All right, you got to go see emergency room. Well, what do you know about blood flow? Well, it's there to bring oxygen to tissues, right? And if blood is pooling, it's not flowing, right? It's not bringing oxygen to this particular tissue, and it's going to die in necrosis as a result. All right, so how do you get the flow started again? Well, somebody has to aspirate it out with a syringe, right? Because we can't just vasodilate. So it actually has to be sucked out of the penis, and that can reestablish the flow. Okay, so that's sort of interesting. Now, there is a neurotransmitter called nitric oxide that is released in the normal circumstance, and that's what causes vasodilation in this area right here. So it's a little bit strange kind of system. Okay. In a physiology class, I don't even talk about that very much. All right. But it is nonetheless interesting. Okay. But not to be messed with if you have an erection over 4 hours. Probably you want to start looking at your watch after about 3 hours, right? Because you'd be very unhappy with the consequences.
And probably very, very
painful. Yeah, probably very painful. So you probably wouldn't have a tendency to let it go. Yeah. An erection that long is usually, well, I've never heard of it occurring naturally. So it's due to pharmacologic support. Okay, yeah.
Ooh.
Okay, so anybody that maybe has problems with, priapism is the official word. So it could be due to pharmaceuticals, but somebody else just mentioned it could be due to other kinds of processes due to blood clotting abnormalities, right? If there are coagulopathies or blood flow abnormalities that are produced by certain kinds of anemias, like sickle cell anemia. That's very interesting. High blood pressure? I think that, when somebody's on blood pressure medication, sometimes it interferes, okay? High blood pressure itself, I don't know of any particular problems, okay? It's not quite as damaging as, say, to your kidneys and your brain and your heart and all the other blood vessels in your body when you have hypertension, okay? All right, so let's move to the female reproductive system. All right, so I promise you all this complicated stuff. Because why? Why do we have all this complicated stuff? To produce something new and unique, right? To make sure there's diversity in the population. All right, so the gonad in the female is the ovary up over here. Now, where do you have an ovary? Where do females have an ovary? In a scrotum?
No.
They're in the pelvic cavity. Totally different spot, right? Pelvic cavity. And what other things do we see right here? So here is the ovary. So the job of the ovary is to produce female sex hormones. And in the female, there are two instead of just one. In the male, there's just one, testosterone. But in the female, there are two. There's estrogen, which is the female counterpart to testosterone. And then something called progesterone. And progesterone is really important. And males don't have a progesterone-like hormone because progesterone helps maintain pregnancy. And what do we call pregnancy? Another name for pregnancy is gestation. So progesterone is a progestational hormone. That's how it got its name. Because during pregnancy, the uterus shouldn't be very irritable and contracting crazily. It should be doing what? Contracting kind of tonically, holding the implantation and the developing fetus, right? Quietly so that it can develop. So that's what progesterone does. It maintains the health of the uterus right here, but also keeps it strong, but kind of quiet so that pregnancy is maintained. Yeah? Not quite. I don't know if we can get to that, but ask me again sort of at the end of the lecture. Somebody had a good question about pregnancy tests. The pregnancy test is going to test for something called human chorionic gonadotropin. And that actually comes from a very interesting tissue, which is part maternal tissue, part fetal tissue, that come together to form an organ inside a woman's body during pregnancy, and that's the placenta. So the placenta is really strange. It's actually two peoples living together, forming an organ. Yeah. Because during the ovulatory cycle and menstrual cycle, which are not necessarily the same in women, they go up and down, okay? And so they're controlling different parts of the reproductive cycle. And so if you adjust the up and down cycles differently, then that throws off the normal rhythm, okay, that is used to control ovulation, okay? And it should be done to throw off ovulation, but not so much so it throws off the ovulatory cycle, but not so much that it disrupts somebody's menstrual cycle. Okay, so when somebody's on these medications, and I think they should still cycle in terms of the menstrual cycle normally, but not so normally that the ovulatory cycle is disrupted. Okay, so yeah, these are all cool things, but we got to do some basic stuff too. It's kind of beyond my expertise to say something about that, you know. I don't know how long they've been available to women and if there's contraindications to these. You know, you really got to talk to a physician to find out because they really know what the data is. But one nice thing about all FDA-approved pharmaceuticals, before they're approved, it goes through years and years and years of documented studies on just cells, and then animal studies, and then human studies, and even after a drug comes, so that, I don't know, that's probably $10 or $20 million are spent trying to develop that drug. But even after a drug comes to market, data is always kept. If it causes any side effects, all those things are reported to the FDA. And, you know, you might be just in that window where people are deciding if it's safe and effective or not. But, you know, the FDA usually does a really good job of yanking things if it's causing problems for people. Okay, but that's such an important issue that I really shouldn't speak about it because I'm not really on the top of my game when it comes to that. But that's also important because those drugs are also important in maintaining healthy bones in postmenopausal women, right? And there's always side effects with that. But so you really do have to educate yourself about that stuff, yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah, so that would prevent fertilization. Okay, so that's maybe not all contraceptives will work that way, but some do. Okay, yeah. Usually. Okay, so in class you learn like the textbook case. Sorry about interrupting you, but you all should know life has a way, right, of getting around all these things to promote diversity because we're all a little bit different. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I've heard of some of the morning after pills, and I don't know the mechanism of action there. Okay. I don't know if it triggers menstruation right away or exactly what it does. Okay. Yeah, no, this is all really good stuff. But I want to teach you guys the basics, okay? Because you got a test coming up a week from today. Okay. All right, so here you have that ovary. What's the job of the ovary? Secrete estrogen and progesterone and also ovulate eggs, oocytes, right? All right, now those oocytes are a lot different than sperm because what don't they have? What does a sperm have that an egg does not have? A flagellum, right? So an egg, all right, once it gets ovulated from this ovary right here, do I have another picture? Maybe this is an okay picture right here, yeah. Notice that the ovary right here is not completely surrounded by the rest of the reproductive system. It's kind of off by itself. It's partially surrounded by a fallopian tube, an end of a fallopian tube. Sometimes we call this a uterine tube. All right. Let me go back to this picture. All right. So when that egg is ovulated, it can float around anywhere in the pelvic cavity, or it could float up in the abdominal cavity. Can it float up into the thoracic cavity? Tell me, can it get into the thoracic cavity? I would say no, because what's between the thoracic cavity and the abdominal cavity? You got the diaphragm, so it can't get up there. But it can float around anywhere in the abdominal cavity and pelvic cavity, all right, just because there's fluid, serous fluid everywhere right there. All right, so how does that egg find its way into the fallopian tube and then hopefully into the uterus right here? Well, it's this fimbria, right? The fimbria just means a lacy end, a feathery end of the fallopian tube. And there's smooth muscle in the fimbria, and so they're sweeping all the time over the surface of the ovary. And the lining, right, of the epithelium of the fallopian tube is ciliated. Guess which way the cilia are beating? Towards the uterus. So it establishes a little flow of pelvic fluid, serous fluid, into the fallopian tube and into the uterus, and that carries the egg with it. All right, so that's why when you see these structures right here, they have a very important function. It captures the egg and makes it flow through the fallopian tube. Now, what happens if there's damage to the fallopian tube? Maybe due to any kind of nonspecific reproductive tract infection, or it could be due to, you know, maybe syphilis or gonorrhea or any kind of inflammation of any kind of pelvic inflammatory disease of the reproductive tract, that's going to scar the fallopian tube, right? It might block the fallopian tube, but it could also be a functional scar by decreasing the motility of those cilia. So then what's going to happen to that egg when it's ovulated? Yeah, it's going to just kind of stop, maybe enter the fallopian tube, but can't get through. Maybe it's going to get stuck in the pelvic cavity right here, all right? But now let's just say that egg is up over here someplace, and all of a sudden we got a bunch of sperm right here. Where's that sperm going to go? Well, maybe there's a functional blockage of fallopian tube because the cilia aren't working, but let's just say it's still patent, there's still a tiny hole, those cilia can swim right past that little blockage, and they're swimming around where? Everywhere in the pelvic cavity, everywhere in the abdominal cavity, and fertilization can take place, right, in any of those places. Normally, it happens in the fallopian tube, right, if all goes well. All right, so now we have a fertilized egg, and are there any blood vessels that that egg can implant next to get nutrients in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity? You know what? Yeah, plenty of vascular supply, because around all of those organs have mesentery, right? All right, so that embryo or that zygote, actually it's a blastocyst, can implant into mesentery, but that mesentery is not lined with this very strong, smooth muscle that we see in the uterus right here. All right, so the blastocyst starts to grow, gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and a placenta starts to develop. And when it gets to a certain size, it just rips away from the blood vessel. Okay, so what do we call that pregnancy when it's at a different location than normal? Normal should be in the uterus right here. What do we call it if it's in the fallopian tube or in mesentery? Yeah, it's called ectopic pregnancy. Ectopic. Ectopic means other than normal site, unusual site for implantation.
What is miscarriage?
Who? Miscarriage. It's any time a fertilized egg dies for whatever reason. It could be all kinds of different reasons. But that is certainly one. If implantation is ectopic, that always means the death of that embryo, because as the placenta starts to rip away from that blood vessel, then the placenta dies and the embryo dies as well. Okay. But when it finally rips away, that causes a massive hemorrhage. And a woman could die in just a matter of minutes when that happens. All right, so it's a very, very serious kind of condition. And I kind of mention that because, you know what, if you know anybody that just became pregnant and they're feeling abdominal or pelvic pain, a lot of times women just don't want to go to the emergency room because they want to maintain their pregnancy at all costs. All right, but it could be a really bad decision because it could cost them their life. So try to support them and get them to emergency room. Make sure that it's a normal pregnancy and not an ectopic, right? Because they might not wake up in the morning. As a matter of fact, a number of years ago, probably 20 years ago, there were signs that were hung in emergency rooms. Think ectopic, because it was missed a lot of times. Somebody would go into emergency room with like right lower quadrant discomfort, and somebody said, well, you know what, that could be an appendicitis, or maybe it's something you ate. Why don't you go home, take some aspirin, which promotes bleeding, unfortunately, right, and come back tomorrow. And people would never make it back to the hospital, right? So now the key is, right, if you have a patient or know somebody that has pelvic pain, abdominal pain, what do you look at? Female, childbearing age, sexually active, right? If all that's positive, then you've got to rule out an ectopic, right, because you could save somebody's life as a result of that. So any kind of infection predisposes women to that particular condition, but it's easy to keep somebody alive after I answer this question.
If you have an ectopic
pregnancy, yeah. And that's a fantastic question, because that's how you protect yourself, okay? Because the hormone that somebody is measuring with a pregnancy test comes from the placenta. And how is the placenta right at the very beginning of pregnancy? It's tiny, tiny, tiny. What's it like the next day? Bigger. And the next day, it's bigger. And so what can you tell me about that human chorionic gonadotropin? It starts off a little bit. It gets bigger. All right, so the levels keep progressively increasing. All right, so when somebody has a history of pelvic inflammatory disease, that's one easy way to check pregnancy, how it's going, by the level of human chorionic gonadotropin. But if all of a sudden it gets to a certain level and it starts to go down, okay, that means that pregnancy is now terminating or is in risk, and chances are it's an ectopic, and then you have to do some imaging studies to find out where it is and get it treated, okay, before it kills the mom. Really difficult situations, right, because most women I know would rather sacrifice themselves than their pregnancy, okay? And you really got to defeat that attitude when somebody has that kind of problem, because indeed they might lose their life, right, if it isn't treated right. Yeah. How do they get rid of the hemorrhage once it happens? Oh, well, I don't know if there's any way to save somebody's life if it happens because it's so fast. But if they catch it, if they identify the ectopic site, then they go in and tie the blood vessels off and then remove the implantation. And you can't take that embryo because it's already distressed. It's probably dead already. It can't be transmitted and transplanted into the uterus, right? Nope, it's not. It's not. Yeah. Okay, but you save your life as a result. Okay, so it's still worth it. All right, so there's an important relationship between what? Structure and function, right? So just like we learned about the function of the heart, here's the function of the fallopian tube and the fimbria and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, if you have a history of pelvic inflammatory disease, but you're interested in having children, you don't have to be concerned because there's really good proper medical care, right, as long as you go seek it, right, from a physician. Okay. All right, so the uterus right here has got a number of different layers. I think we're going to ask you to know three layers of the uterus, right, the perimetrium on the outside, and then, oh, yeah, hi. That's the fallopian tubes that are ligated, means there's like a suture, a little band that's placed around the fallopian tube. So what would that look like? So there would be a ligature placed here and here, and then, so there's nothing that can get by, and then they're actually, then it's cut. Okay? So does that reverse itself? Probably very rare. But then again, you know, life has a way of figuring things out sometimes, right? So I don't know how, I would never say something is 100% all the time. Yeah. Yeah, there's still always a possibility, yeah. So, huh? You know, I don't know what the percentage is, okay? And if you're really serious about it, well, maybe you should remove the whole vas deferens, right? And not just snip it and keep the ends close to each other so they approximate each other. Just take out a big section of it and throw it out, okay? Okay. All right, so we got the perimetrium, we got the endometrium, and the endometrium is a special epithelium because that's the layer that builds up every month during the menstrual cycle and then it's sloughed off. So it develops, it proliferates, there's a lot of mitosis taking place in the endometrium right here. A lot of blood vessels go into the endometrium in preparation for implantation, and all those things disappear at the end of the cycle, okay? And they're lost from the body in that period of, what, mild hemorrhage, it just flushed from the body. Okay, that's the endometrium. And then the myometrium is the big, thick layer. All right, and what do you think the strongest muscle in the human body is? Biceps? Nice, big, strong male biceps? No, it's got to be cervix or the uterus, right? Because we could get, like, the biggest, most famous weightlifter in the world and have them give them a 9-pound weight and say, okay, hold that weight out for 9 months. Would they be able to do that? No way, right? Okay, but the uterus, right, is designed to do that kind of thing. All right, and the inferior part right here is what we call the cervix, and through the cervix is the cervical canal. And on, so here is the external cervical orifice right here. We call that the external os, O-S. Here's the internal os. Otherwise, you might call that like the birth canal. And, of course, that's one of the functions of the vagina right here. It acts like a birth canal as well. And you can see the cervix is kind of dome-shaped, right? So there's an indentation right here that we call a fornix, all right? So I'm probably looking at, what, the anterior fornix, posterior fornix, but you also have, what, a right and left lateral fornix forming the cervix. Okay. Well, we just talked a little bit about sexually transmitted disease and how it can cause problems later on in life for pregnancies because of scar tissue that forms. But I got another kind of question for you. When are we done in here today? I got a half hour, right? Okay, half hour. Another a question for you guys, and that is cancer a sexually transmitted disease? A lot of people are shaking their head. No. Some people say yes. Okay. Other people say yes. Well, should I tell you what I think? Okay. there is a virus called human papillomavirus, okay? And we know about maybe 110, 120 different strains of human papillomavirus, and four of those strains can infect the cervix and cause dysplastic changes. It changes the genetic nature of them and how it proliferates. And those changes lead to cervical cancer. Okay, and without that, and so this is the case of most of cervical cancer, right? We can find those viruses. There are other conditions that produce cervical cancer, which are kind of interesting. Maybe I'll mention. All right, so, and how do you get human papillomavirus? Through intimate sexual contact. So I would have to say, in my mind, yeah, cervical cancer is a sexually transmitted disease because it's caused, in most cases, by human papillomavirus.
Right.
Okay, so, you know, it's just really a shame that that's such a secret, because there's almost 7,000 women that die of cervical cancer in the United States every year. All right, and why is that a shame? Well, because people don't get a pap smear. Right, they should get a pap smear, I don't know, in your age group, once a year or something like that. And cervical cancer is a very slow-growing cancer, so you have years to find it and years to get rid of it when you find those little cells here that are changing their shape and their function. With a little cryosurgery, it can be cured, 100% cured, right, before it becomes cancer. With cryosurgery, what do I mean?
Freezing.
It's freezing. Okay, it seems easy to me. I don't know, for the individual. Probably really easy, right? With a little liquid nitrogen, and you're cured. With proper follow-up, you don't ever have to have cervical cancer. And the other thing that's kind of amazing is that it is, you know, with education, it's 100% preventable as well. All right, so that's really sad that all these women are dying. And you might want to think about why that is. Okay? Why are all those women dying? I don't want to say, but it's sort of interesting. Okay, well, you're going to say, well, because of the virus. Well,
yeah.
That doesn't explain why people are ignorant, though. Okay? Yeah.
Endometriosis.
Yeah, I'll tell you what I know about it. I'm not an expert. But anyway, we were saying that once a month, the endometrium, which is what part of the uterus right here?
The inner one.
Is shed, right, during menstruation through the cervical canal and then, of course, out the vagina right here. But when this, and why is that lining shed? It's shed because it proliferates, it grows during the first part of the menstrual cycle getting ready for implantation. So these cells, there's like a switch that triggers these cells to divide and grow. And what does that kind of remind you of when there's a cell that divides and grows very rapidly? It almost sounds like a cancerous process, right? And so a lot of respects, this is true, okay? So those cells can be turned on and off. They can undergo mitosis very rapidly or with a proper control, right? They regress and then they slough off. But when something is in the uterus right here, even though the fallopian tube has normal flow from the fimbria down into the uterus, some of those cells, for whatever reason, we're not really sure, end up retrograding out the fallopian tube, past the fimbria, and where are they now? They're in the pelvic cavity. And they can find their way to the abdominal cavity. And if when they get into the pelvic cavity, if they're not dead, and many cells make it they're alive, they can find a vascular supply around the mesentery, or on the surface of the uterus, the perimetrium, or around the fimbria or fallopian tube, right? And they might find enough nutrients and oxygen to stay alive. All right, but what are they always going to be listening for? For hormone levels from the ovary right here that is controlling the normal function of the endometrium. So during that part of the menstrual cycle, those cells that found their way into the pelvic cavity, they're going to proliferate and grow. And that causes severe discomfort for some people. And it might cause adhesions and maybe blockages of different parts of their body, because those are endometrial cells that are growing, right, not in the uterus, but in other parts of the pelvic and abdominal cavity. Don't really know how to treat it, I don't think, very well. Surgery, you can go in, but remember, every time you do surgery, you got scarring. But we're coming up with new kinds of compounds that maybe we could put in the pelvic cavity to reduce adhesions later on. Because remember, your intestines are doing what? They're moving around all the time. So if there's adhesions, that's problems. And that's one of the problems with endometriosis. It can produce all kinds of strange symptoms besides just discomfort. All right, and I think, fortunately, postmenopausally, endometriosis has a tendency to subside because you're not triggering those cells into that proliferative period. Okay, but I could be wrong with that. Okay, so surgical interventions maybe work sometimes. I would say maybe not all that often. Okay, but it's those cells from the endometrium that end up in the pelvic cavity. Okay, all right, so we're down to the cervix right here. So we're talking about benign prostate disease, right? And we don't really know, and cancer of the prostate is very prevalent. We don't really know what causes it, but we say low-fat, high-exercise diet is a good thing. But you know what? It might be due to a human papilloma kind of virus. We just have no clue at the moment. So that might be another sexually transmitted disease. So I would pay attention to that in your lifetime. That might be a real important, we don't know how to treat viral infections though very well, unfortunately. Okay. Okay, vagina. That's just a birth canal. All right, but it also collects sperm, which is good for fertilization. And then down over here we have the vulva. The vulva is made up of the clitoris. That's analog tissue to the male penis. So it's erectile tissue and contains a lot of nervous tissue, and that just stimulates proper sexual behaviors, right, for reproduction. And then the labia majorum and minorum right here that protect the vestibule, and which also protects the external vaginal orifice right here. But look at over here, the external urethral orifice. So where does the urethra, there's a female urethra and any part of the female reproductive system join together? No, they're always separate. You might have noticed with other animals that you dissected in lab, if you did a pig or if we did a rat or cat, you notice that in those animals the urethra does join the vagina. All right, so humans are pretty much unique in that respect, and that of course protects the female reproductive tract from infection. Okay, not that it still can't happen, but it certainly reduces that effect. But notice how short that urethra is, and that's probably why females are more prone to urinary tract infections than men are. But the best way to protect yourself from urinary tract infection is not to really invoke your immune system, but just to use mechanical means. Right, like your skin is just a mechanical means that protects you from infection. It keeps bacteria out of your body, right? So as long as your skin, your integument is continuous, you go a long way in protecting yourself from infection, unless you're doing what? Poking your nose, poking your eye, chewing on your fingernails, things like that, right? Then swine flu can get right in there. Don't touch your face with your hands, all right? But mechanical, we also mean tears flush bacteria out of our eyes. Urine flushes bacteria out of the urinary tract. So staying well hydrated and voiding, right, protects yourself from bladder infections. Okay, what else do I want to say about this? Not too much, I don't think. Let me just look a little bit at some of these slides right here. Okay, so those are the major parts of the female reproductive tract. I think this is an exam figure, so let's go over it real quick. Oh, but it also shows a nice cross-section of an ovary right here, and inside the ovary, you can see many, many immature follicles. You can see a mature follicle. Where's the mature follicle at? Ah, I see it. Right here. So here's a mature follicle, and attached to the wall of that follicle right there, that's an oocyte, ready for ovulation. All right, so some people were asking about contraceptive agents. So as a follicle is developing from one of these immature follicles to a mature one, it is secreting primarily estrogen. Okay, and that estrogen is making the endometrium grow and proliferate. It's also allowing the glandular tissue of the breast to proliferate and mature. Right, but right at ovulation, right, the follicle doesn't go away. It gets converted into another important endocrine structure. It's turned into a corpus luteum. Right, so the egg is out making its way through the fallopian tube, hopefully, and the remnants of the follicle then become the corpus luteum, and at that point, the corpus luteum sort of stops secreting estrogen and starts to secrete progesterone. And that's what's going to put the final touches on the development of the endometrium, and it's going to make the myometrium nice and strong. And that's what's necessary if implantation takes place. And that progesterone has to maintain the pregnancy for 9 months. Now, somebody was asking about that human chorionic gonadotropin. Human chorionic gonadotropin comes from the placenta after implantation takes place. Normally, if there's no implantation, the corpus luteum regresses and dies and stops secreting progesterone, and that triggers another round of ovulation, right, another cycle. But if implantation takes place, the placenta starts to secrete a little human chorionic gonadotropin, and it goes to the corpus luteum, and it tells the corpus luteum, don't regress, pregnancy has occurred, implantation has occurred, and we want you to keep secreting progesterone because I'm here. I'm healthy, I'm happy, but if you stop secreting progesterone, I'm going to die. So human chorionic gonadotropin tells the corpus luteum to stick around, right, until the end of, well, eventually it's going to regress because as soon as the placenta gets big enough, it can secrete enough estrogen and progesterone on its own to maintain pregnancy. But in that crossover period of time, the corpus luteum is important to maintain pregnancy for maybe about 2 or 3 weeks, all right? Okay. So what do you see on this figure? Well, the nice ovary right there, you can see the broad ligament, which is attaching the fallopian tube with the uterus and even the ovary, right? So this is all broad ligament right here, right? Here is the round ligament, okay? Right here. Okay, ovarian ligament. It's an ovarian ligament that holds the ovary in place as well, yeah? Okay. And then for the fallopian tube, we can see the fimbria. Remember, they're like fingers that are constantly sweeping over the ovary right here, trying to capture eggs so they don't wander around. Infundibulum, and then here's the ampulla. So the ampulla is like this little swelling at the end of the fallopian tube. And here's the fallopian tube, and then the isthmus. So the isthmus means a narrowing. It's a narrowing of the fallopian tube. And then finally into the body of the uterus. This top part is the fundus, right? The lumen is just the inner layer. You can see the internal, external os. What else do you have to know on this thing right here? Cervical canal, the different layers. Okay, that's pretty much about it for this particular view right here. Okay, now, boy, there was something else that's interesting. I don't know if I can remember my number. So here is female gonad, namely ovary, okay? And these follicles are maturing, so usually 1 a month matures for ovulation. Sometimes more than one might, and somebody might end up with twins, or maybe with pharmaceuticals, you can super ovulate and end up with 8, okay? Rah! That might be a little bit too many for most people, okay? So usually 1 a month, but unlike spermatogenesis in the male, which continues through their whole lifespan, the amount of eggs, what we call primordial follicles, that a woman has is determined before they're born, okay? So after that period of time, a woman can never develop any more eggs. It's all determined by these prenatal period. And so some women feel kind of bad about that. Maybe Octomom might feel a little bit bad about that. But you know what? I would say it's not much of a concern because, all right, as the ovary develops, I think you have about 250 million primordial oocytes. Okay? And 500,000. 500,000. Sorry, not millions. 500,000. Okay. It was millions. Maybe you'd just be like a big ovary someplace. But it's only a little part of your body. Okay. About 500,000. By the time you're born, 100,000 have already died. And then by the time you reach puberty, okay, another 200,000 die. So by the time you're ready to reproduce, you have about 50,000 left. But is that enough for anybody? For most people, that's more than enough. You wouldn't want to have more than 50,000 babies anyway. So that's really not such a big deal, okay? But just remember that this development of oocytes is a fetal process. It doesn't happen postnatally as it does in the male. So kind of another difference. All right, let me just go over to my slides in the computer and see if there's anything else that I really want to say. Okay. I might want to say something about the menstrual cycle and ovulatory cycle. Maybe not. Oh, I don't really have much to say. Oh, I can't show you this. Okay. I have an interesting slide right here, which I can't show you. I can't turn it around. And usually I start this lecture off with this, but since we have a couple minutes, I'll end it. I'll end the lecture. All right, but you might have a hard copy. Oh, here it is right here. Okay. Here is something interesting. And this didn't start in California. This actually started in Texas, all right? And here's the thing that says no shame, no blame, no names, all right? So what's interesting about California is that there are safe haven laws, and not everybody is aware of these things, okay? But what a safe haven law says is that if you have a newborn baby, and every county is a little bit different, some give you 24 hours, some 48 hours, you can take a newborn baby and take it to an emergency room or a fire station and surrender the baby, and they won't even ask your name or any information. They'll just take it from you, and then you have no obligation to raise the baby, or nobody can sue you for any reason, even if there's child abuse at that point in time. So what's the purpose of that kind of law? That's to prevent finding babies in dumpsters and things like that. Okay, and that happens. I know there's a USC student, and they think that she's actually dumped a couple children already, all right? Of course, it's all unproven. Ooh, this is going on the Internet. So that's allegedly, all right? So anyway, if you know anybody that's pregnant, and pregnancy is a very difficult time, not just with the mom, but the whole family, the whole support system, and the dad, you know, hormones are going all over the place, and sometimes you might make you might know somebody that might make a bad decision. Be sure to educate people about these safe haven laws, and they can surrender their newborn baby, and no questions will be asked, and hopefully, I'm sure that, I don't know how many lives that saves in California, but I'm sure quite a few. Yeah.
So if you have baby in the hospital, though, can you surrender?
Absolutely. Yeah, you have 24 hours. LA County, it might be even a week. All right, so I give you the website, and so I would check a particular website for your particular locale. You know, if you might know somebody that needs to take advantage of that program. Okay, so, yeah, you might find other people, but do it legally. Just don't give them away.
Although here was just a guy in Indiana dropped off all 8 of his kids.
All 8? So it wasn't. Please, let's write a law. Take them all. Yeah, they had to amend it. Yeah, you only have a certain period of time. Yeah, another question? Well, you know, the more that you leave with a child, maybe the better off the child will be, you know, in terms of medical background and things like that. But, you know, it's just best to find a home for these kids, even if you don't want to give any information, that's fine. Yeah. Oh, and the other thing is, well, I'll give it to you in a second, but the other thing is, you know, if you know something about the mom's medical history, but what can you tell me about the baby? It's a new and different person. You know, and sometimes genetics helps But a lot of times it's such a new and different person that, you know, they're going to be a new and unique individual. So medical history of the parents is not all that important. Yeah.
Okay, you mentioned about things about, you know, but what is it that makes it like identical?
Exactly. What makes it identical? Okay, identical twins is when, identical twins happens when there is one egg ovulated and then it fertilizes, becomes a zygote, so it can become a normal full human being by itself, but in that process it splits into two.
So it goes,
yeah, so then now two of them are going to undergo mitosis, and since it has the same egg and same sperm, they're going to be identical. But even then, you know, you might see, if you're familiar with identical twins, they're not exactly identical, even though they have identical eggs and sperm.
What about the genes? Are they identical?
Who?
The genes,
yeah, the DNA should be identical. The DNA should be identical, but you know, we're learning that other things that we do with our life changes our DNA. And so maybe they start out identical, but again, it can change a little bit. So we're learning different kinds of like xenobiotics, chemicals that come from the environment can permanently turn certain genes off and maybe turn certain genes on. And so you're not really the same person you were when you were born, we're beginning to learn, which is pretty fascinating. Yeah, a little scary too, because you don't know what you're eating, if it's like changing who you are just by eating something. But that's true with information. Just by coming to anatomy lecture, you're not the same person you are before compared to after either. So again, you know, there's all kinds of things that change. Who else had a question? Yeah. Exam figures and the slides that I gave you too. But you know what? Those end of chapter questions are always important. So hopefully I touched on everything that might be in the end of chapter questions.
So don't worry about ovulation administration.
I didn't have time to go over that. But I would know something about in the male, what's something about that seminiferous tubule and what cells secrete testosterone, which ones support spermatogenesis, you know, Sertoli cells. Which ones are inside the tube, which ones are outside the tube. Okay, like the cells of Leydig secrete testosterone. Yeah. Digestive system. Reproductive, okay, hold on a second. I can't hear the question, you guys. Hold on. So what chapter? Reproductive system. Yeah, you have to study the figures, but I would study all of the information on the slide, the handout, and the end of chapter questions. That probably reinforces what I was talking about. Okay? Because I didn't give you any web assignments ever. Okay. All right, so the final is week from today. Yeah, so it'll be Monday.
What are you going to hold the grade for
the lab? I'll probably get the lab grades really soon and put it online when I get them. Okay?
All right.
Whenever I know.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.